It is Thursday, March 1st, 2018. Very, very cold out there. Drive carefully. I'm well aware, been doing this show a long time, there are people listening to this in their cars, such as the technology today, of course. Be careful wherever you're driving. The roads are treacherous. The weather has been bad. Looking forward to speaking to my guest this evening. He's in New Zealand today. First came across him some years ago. He was on a very interesting documentary about the 7th of July attacks, a documentary on the BBC. Got him onto a radio programme I was making in Spain, and he's been a mate ever since. He's a very, very good journalist, former BBC journalist, and currently the host of the politics show at BCFM in Bristol. Do check out online thisweek.org.uk, thisweek.org.uk. And I've said before, I don't know of anybody else who's done as much research and work into looking into the secret society, the Bilderberg Group. You can also check out a website, bilderberg.org. We've spoken a lot about that over the years as well. He's in New Zealand, so he's not braving the cold weather here in the UK today. It's obviously better where he is. Welcome back, Tone. What are you doing in New Zealand?
Just holidaying and having a lovely time, actually. It's absolutely fascinating coming over to the other part of another part of the world, really the opposite side of to you guys, and seeing how actually the same sort of things go on here, you know, with political scandals, and really interesting looking at several of the things in the news over here that have been either misreported, not reported at all, reported badly, but really the same symptoms of a criminal elite in the top positions of power. And I suppose it's really just simply that, you know, finance is controlling our political parties, and nobody is going to get into any of these key positions unless there's some sort of agenda to steer the population in the way that they want, not the way we want.
Absolutely, Tony. Do you know, it's interesting you being there in New Zealand, and thanks for giving us some of your time on your holiday as well. I thought you might have been on work detail. Honestly, I did this time of the year, and I thought, I mean it, I wouldn't have invited you on if I had known that. I'm kind of kicking myself now for eating into your holiday. So thanks for doing that. No, but I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't take liberties like that, but thanks for doing it. You're in New Zealand, and the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse has reported on the more than 2,000 children that were basically kidnapped in 1945 up to 1970 and sent out to various places in the British Empire, basically forcibly sent abroad, taken from their families. They were poor children, and many of these children ended up being, you know, horrifically sexually abused. Many of them went to New Zealand, of course. Many of them went to Australia. I wonder, Tony, stories, and I know we're going to talk about quite a bit. We'll talk about Press Freedom, Mosley. You're very interested in the European Union Army and the United States and NATO. We'll talk about that. But I wonder when stories like this come out, and it came out, of course, in 2009, but now they're putting more detail on what happened to some of these children. I wonder, will it give people a moment of pause? Those people who listen to the politics show on BCFM and have heard stories about sexual abuse committed by the establishment figures of the past, and maybe people have dismissed that and said it's just crazy conspiracy theory. I wonder, will learning about these children that were kidnapped and spirited away to Australia, New Zealand, I wonder, will it make people think twice, Tony?
Well, I hope so. I think that there's a big resistance, isn't there, amongst most people, to even contemplate that such evil could be operating at the heart of power. But, I mean, a lot of what's been going on with the National Inquiry, I think, is really effectively a continuation of the abuse. I mean, Alexis Jay, who's, I think, the fourth or fifth person to chair it, is not a serious chair of that inquiry. There's been no real looking into the most serious allegations, which are to do with the Secret Services, particularly Sir Peter Hayman, who's the deputy head of MI6, being a serial paedophile. These revelations were, I think, about 3 years ago, and yet still nothing's happened about that. Also, of course, I wouldn't necessarily call him a paedophile, but Ted Heath, who it's now almost 100% certain was abusing young men. I mean, we're talking about underage men, young boys, really, the age, you know, early teens. And this then is actively going on now, this story. And we just to see also the attacks on the Wiltshire chief constable for saying that you know, Heath was an abuser. So there's nothing happening really with this inquiry. It's not taking anywhere near enough evidence. Alexis Jay has been appointed because she ran the Rotherham inquiry into the ground, and I say that effectively because there was no prosecutions of any senior people in the police or the social services who were supposed to be protecting the kids in Rotherham. And so she is the establishment's ideal candidate to kick this whole inquiry into the long grass. Finally, really important, I think, to stress David Icke's role in getting this initially out there to the public. Things like the Savile, Jimmy Savile, actually talking about all that way before any of the news broke. And the news only just broke because of a persistence of Marion Jones and also Liz McKean at Newsnight, who lost their jobs, lost their careers as a result. Well, I don't know about Marion losing his career because he's still working, but them losing their jobs at Newsnight from making sure that this was exposed to a national audience through Miles Goslett, the freelance reporter. So there was a massive pushback even at the time, and there still is, I think, against this core of a blackmailing fraternity at the heart of the British establishment, which, you know, it seems is still there, because there's the evidence really for that is that the exposure of Savile happened through the Richard Ingram's magazine, The Oldie, and then 6 months later, Richard Ingram's was given his marching orders by The Oldie. He was kicked out. And I would say that was a direct result of publishing the Savile story. Richard, by the way, was one of the initial founders of, or early editors of Private Eye. And he left Private Eye, and Private Eye was one of the other institutions or magazines or whatever in London that would not publish the story about Savile being pulled from Newsnight. So this is, it's ongoing, Richie.
It is, mate. Do you share my, it's hard to say, belief? You've got to be responsible, don't you, as a journalist? But I believe the Palace, Buckingham Palace, must have known about what Savile was up to. They must have known. You know,
of course.
Yeah, because you have to be responsible. I've never, ever on this programme suggested that, you know, Prince Charles, the heir to the throne, who was very, very close friends with Savile, I've never suggested any impropriety on his behalf, ever. I wouldn't tolerate it unless there was evidence to support it. But I always said, if you were heading up that investigation, you'd like to have a private, informal chat with any of Savile's closest confidants to ask them for any little bits of information that might help you further the inquiries into, you know, obviously Savile is dead, but into what he did and whom was around with him. The Palace must have known. They must have known, Tony.
Well, I think it's pretty clear they did know, and they do know. The other thing which corroborates that is the evidence of the Jersey Senator Stuart Sivray, who pointed out not only sexual abuse over in the Channel Islands. I mean, you know, there's a tremendous amount was going on over there, but also emotional abuse of mentally ill people, putting them in solitary confinement, this sort of thing over there. Really, that was the point at which I think the big test comes for Buckingham Palace and for the monarchy, for the Queen particularly, and the establishment in that way, in that obviously if this sort of thing is going on in a place where the monarch appoints the senior people in Jersey, that something needs to change. At that point, I think it became absolutely clear to me that the royal family is absolutely 100% implicated in this. And of course, the problem is that they have crown immunity from any kind of criminal prosecution, being the Crown Prosecution Service.
They can never be indicted, to use that word. We don't use that word very often here in the UK, but they can't be charged with anything, with conspiracy to pervert.
I think actually I think legally they can, but it would take a very brave chief constable somewhere to do that, simply because of the important role of the Crown in prosecuting any criminal offence. So I think that they've used this in a very cynical manner, this immunity from prosecution, and I don't see anything changing until the Queen dies, and in which case all hell will break loose. I mean, who knows what's going to happen then? Because I think there's a genuine difference between the William Harry generation, having seen him over here on the telly last night, chatting away at some sort of, I'm not sure what that do was. These are different. They're much more relaxed, much more natural, and it seems to me more honest than Prince Charles, who always looks like a kind of stuffed shirt. He's always extremely guarded. And he looks to me as if he's up to all sorts. You know, I'm not just talking about the body language. He's someone who's very much involved in this conspiracy. And
well, he knows a lot anyway, Tony. He certainly knows a lot. And you know, if Prince Andrew wasn't Prince Andrew, if he was Andrew from Milton Keynes, he would have been interviewed under caution because he was on Lolita flights with Jeffrey Epstein, wasn't he? I mean, we know this to be, we know he visited some of these places where children were spirited away. Again, I'm not accusing him of anything. I wouldn't dream of, the gutter truth or industrial complex will do that. They will call people names and they have no evidence to support it. I wouldn't accuse him of anything. But if it was me or you and we knew Epstein and we were involved in Clinton and all of that, we'd be hauled in and asked questions, Tony.
Yeah, I think the thing is in this game, Richie, you've got to be absolutely clear, 100% clear. If you're interested in truth, you've got to be absolutely clear in the separating line between speculation and fact. And yes, it's fine to speculate, you know, of course, so long as it's couched in those terms. So, I mean, that's my take on all this. And I think, you know, there's this criminal elite. We've got two major problems with them at the moment. One is war, because they're quite clearly preparing for a major war. If you look at what's been going on with the US particularly, ramping up with, you know, basically putting Trump in power, who is this sort of maniac with his finger on the button who actually never says no to a man in a uniform, we hear. That's one of the little phrases. Anything that the military say, Trump just nods his head, and he's interested a bit in domestic policy, but he really just ceded foreign policy.
That's right.
To people like Mad Dog Mattis. But the other thing is the economic crash, and this is becoming more and more obvious that it's going to happen. And I was just amazed a few weeks ago, I'm sure you probably covered this, to see the £166 trillion time bomb. This is Mervyn King, the former Bank of England governor, warning that the debt will trigger the next financial meltdown.
Right. That's right.
He also says that the private sector debt to GDP ratio is much higher now than before the crash. So this, what he's effectively saying is, look, guys, they've done absolutely nothing about the conditions that led to the 2008 financial crisis, which, by the way, wasn't a crash. It was a bailout, which irritates me every time I hear a professional economist talk about it as a crash. It wasn't. And this is all ready to go again. But this time will be 10 times bigger. And governments simply would not be able to borrow enough money. They haven't got the credit rating to bail out anything. So it would just be a complete financial collapse with a few extremely rich institutions left, governments bankrupt, and in the situation where they have to, you know, desperately run to creditors, probably massively start taxing people, maybe finally people who are super rich, although the super rich seem to control our governments.
And signing over.
Anyway, that would be a massive crisis, and it's coming.
And signing over whatever natural public assets are left. That's what it's all about. And that crisis will be triggered by a hike in interest rates. I was listening to Carney talking about this a few weeks back, and I had a conversation with an economist off air, and he said, I have been listening a bit to you, because I used to do financial correspondence 20 years ago. I was always the Muppet thrown out to interview the economists when I worked in commercial radio. I'm familiar with the lexicon, with the terminology. And you know, they're going to raise interest rates, and that's going to bring about this crash. But I just want to go back to this warmongering. Obviously, one of the biggest stories of the week has been the claims that Bashar the Bastard has been waging chemical weapons or raining chemical weapons down on children and women and innocents in Ghouta. Hotly disputed, of course, by Assad and disputed by the Russians as well. The evidence being provided by the White Helmets, dubious group of so-called first responders, but they have an agenda to partition Syria. It's on their website. Mad. And, of course...
Yeah, that's important to mention also that they're run by British intelligence.
By British intelligence.
This is an intelligence outfit. You
know. That's right. So, but what's been interesting, Tony, is they did their pathos-filled broadcasts with Kay Burley and Dominic Waghorn almost crying for the children of Syria. They were ramping this up all week long. But it seems that the public are just completely immune to it now. And are not. I'm not hearing people talking about, oh, it's terrible, all those children being killed, we've got to do something about it. It doesn't seem to be working. What do you think?
No, I don't. I think you're right. I think that what's happened is the propaganda has stopped working because I think mainly due to martyrs, like David Kelly, people who during the Iraq War made it absolutely as clear as they could to the public before then being assassinated that this was all being fixed up. We now know that, of course, that it was, and it's completely known all around the world that the dodgy dossier, Iraq weapons of mass destruction, was a lie. And we're seeing exactly the same sort of thing happening today. And I don't even think most journalists have got really any interest in this. They might even be covering it with a little bit less enthusiasm. This is a lie, the weapons of mass destruction, blah, blah, which has passed its sell-by date.
I remember you talking years ago. When I first started making programs like this, because when the Gulf War broke out, the first Gulf War, I wasn't working in radio. I was still in high school, towards the end of high school. But when I got into commercial radio production and presenting, even then, people were still citing a story that had been discredited. That story, I think you were one of the first people to ever talk about it on one of my programs, that incubator story where the Iraqis were taking the babies out of incubators in Kuwait, leaving the babies to die and running away with the incubators. It's like, how many of these lies, these human interest stories dressed up to evoke an emotional response from the citizens of the West, how many of them will they carry on with? But I think what we're seeing this week is nobody, at least in among my circle of contacts, people are just not paying any attention to it. It's not working. You know, we're not stupid. We know that Assad has to deal with the situation of Ghouta. It's on the doorstep of Damascus. Jihadi Wahhabist nutcases are entrenched in that area and they have to be gotten out of there. And unfortunately, and I don't say this, you know, glibly, I don't say it lightly, obviously, when you do that, people are going to die. It's a terrible thing, but innocent people will die in the attempt to get these beheading nutters out of that part of the country. It's a fact, and it cannot be avoided now. But we go back to, Tony, something you and I spoke about back in 2011, 2012, 13, 14. The situation in Syria wasn't manufactured by an evil regime. It was manufactured by the intelligence agencies that we were speaking about a few minutes ago.
Well, by the same people that overthrew Saddam and Gaddafi. And it was, you know, one of the next in line for that. Now, the interesting, I don't know if you've checked out Thierry Masson. I don't know how much you've checked his work over the years. He runs the Voltaire Network in France. It's actually mostly in French language, but they almost always do pretty instant English language translations. I think it's one of those go-to sites. Anything important going on, I tend to have a look. And he was the first person after the 9/11 attacks. I was sitting in my little office in Bristol a couple of months after 9/11, sort of scratching my head thinking, gosh, this looks bad, you know. And I got two books in the post from him. One was Pentagate, and I'm not sure what the other one was. But anyway, he'd managed to write and publish two books within a space of a couple of months about the 9/11 conspiracy. And I picked these books up, started reading, and I suddenly thought, God, this really is a, you know, this is, the whole thing is a lie. You know, 9/11 is a load of rubbish. And it happened, but it was orchestrated. And so Thierry's just literally in the last day or so now saying that their Russian regular army is now in Damascus. So it looks to me as if this whole business of the Russians backing Assad has gone up a level with Russian infantry in Damascus. And I would imagine that they will be used to clear these people out. But it just shows how absolutely 100% committed Moscow is to making sure there is no regime change.
And there's nobody reporting this, Tony. Nobody outside of this website is reporting it. Nobody. The Russian, like Russian right. regular... Well, no, I'm asking you. I've not seen this today. This is really interesting.
Right, well, this I was looking at this last night. That's because Voltaire Network is on the list of fake news, even though it's one of the best informed, most reliable sites in the world. Of course, that's classed as fake news to the fake news corporate media. So anyway, all I'd do is just suggest people bookmark that and have a look. You know, I'm not saying everything Thierry Masson writes is 100% correct, but on things like this, he's very, very good. And he's very well informed. He's got very good connections also to French intelligence over the years. He's proved that. And I think this is the sort of thing that we need to understand. There is going to be no regime change in Syria. And I think in a way, Richie, I'm looking at, I mean, the tactics that Putin and the Russians have used is masterful. What they've done in Syria is they've coaxed the Americans, the British, the West in so much that the British military, the American military, the Saudi military are all completely convinced that they're just about to take over the country. They're now absolutely committed in their hearts. I mean, this is a psychological thing that Putin's done to taking over the country. And what Putin's done here is he's effectively said, look, the more you try and take over the country, the more you're going to fail. And so they're in a trap, effectively. So they've smelt blood with the idea of, you know, in a way, I mean, of course, Gaddafi, they got Gaddafi's blood, they got Saddam's blood. They're smelling blood with Syria because of the way that the Russians and Assad have allowed them to take almost as much as is possible without actually controlling the country. So in a way, Syria is the big trap that the West has fallen into, and they're going to, I think, continue to try and take it until they realise they've lost.
Do you remember the lies, Tony? We are going to talk about NATO, the United States and the European Union Army in a minute with Tony. Tony's going to stay with us for about 25 more minutes. Very kind of him. It's great to have him back on the programme. Thisweek.org.uk, the politics show on BCFM. Don't miss it. It really is a rarity. It is in radio today. I can tell you that for a fact. Tony's in New Zealand at the moment. It's coming up for 2 minutes to the top of the hour. You know, I'm looking back, Tony, at the lies they told about the imminent overthrowing, the imminent, you know, civilian massacre that was going to happen in cities in Libya. It was said by Alain Juppé, if I remember, the French foreign minister lying through his teeth at the United Nations. Liars, liars and damned liars. And I think the Foreign Affairs Select Committee in this country, even in 2016, came out with a report that said it was all lies, basically. All the lies, all the stories told about the imminent threat to civilians in Libya was just lies. They downplayed the massive Islamist element in the so-called rebel forces. Of course, we saw that in Syria as well. It's stunning, Tony, that when these stories are being told about Syria and about war crimes and chemical weapons, that, you know, senior journalists, alleged journalists like Adam Bolton at Sky, like Andrew Marr at the BBC, Fiona Bruce, that they don't have the balls, Tony, to say to these politicians like Boris Johnson, well, hang on a second, pal. Let's talk about the Foreign Affairs Select Committee report on Libya. Let's talk about all this. It's not even like 50 years ago, Tony. It's like, you know, it's like in the overall sea of time, it's only a pond. It's only been a couple of years ago. It's the same lies. It's word for word the same lies by the same people.
Well, they're living in a groupthink bubble, really. They're not subject to... You know, in a way, it's a bit like the super rich. You know what it's like with the super rich, and it's fascinating. I would always always encourage your listeners to go to a Bilderberg conference, take a few days off, you know, and go along to these, because you often get the chance to actually meet these people, you know, the super rich that run the world. Their whole persona is fascinating to behold, in that they're quite clearly just surrounded by sycophants. They're so rich that all the people around them just sort of nod their heads and agree with them. It's really so medieval to watch that there is no subjecting any of their thinking to any kind of critical. It's a bit like, I suppose, the way that a lot of modern schools now don't do encourage critical thinking in the way that they did, certainly, you know, in the 1970s when I was at school. There was a lot of encouragement of critical thinking, like almost like the teacher would say, and actually physically did once, I can always remember, don't believe what I'm telling you, think for yourself. You know, that isn't happening at all, no. Really, I don't think it's certainly amongst our elite anymore. And also, that's the same, it's the same attitude going on in many of the London newsrooms. Of course, all the media in Britain is focused in London, all the national coverage, all the international coverage is done in London, so it's easy to contain there. I think it would make a big difference if we had regional newsrooms that were covering national, international stories. So say, for example, the Manchester Guardian started up, you know, in Manchester, but eventually moved to London to become part of the Borg. But if we had more regional, and actually one good national, I suppose you'd call it national paper, is the Glasgow Herald. There's a lot more independent writing and thinking in the Herald than you ever see in any London paper. But that's the way it works, I'm afraid. And anybody that really starts to question these things, you'll find them that they won't be appearing on the news the next evening. I mean, as we, you know, we were talking about earlier with Liz McKean at Newsnight.
We might have just momentarily lost Tony there. He's in New Zealand. It's early in the AM there, so he shouldn't be being swamped by many users in his vicinity. Oh, we have a serious problem there now.
Yeah. Hi.
Ah, you're there. I thought we were going to lose you entirely there. When you answered me last time, I could hear some sort of noise in the background, but I couldn't hear you. But thankfully you're there. Did you manage to get a cuppa there, or do you want to take time to grab a quick cuppa?
No, fine. Yeah, I'm fine again.
Brilliant.
Now.
Well, we'll do 20 more minutes, Tone, and we're very grateful. I didn't realise you were on holiday. I'm still kicking myself over that. So thanks for doing that. It's important stuff. You got cut off when you were referring back to the Newsnight Jimmy Savile story, and that segues nicely into Max Mosley and the revelations and news today. News that emerged when you were in bed in the land of Nod, Tony, because you're 13 hours ahead of us. The Culture Secretary has said the government will not implement the second stage of the Leveson inquiry. The Labour Party are saying this is absolutely outrageous. I'm not, you know, too thrilled about coming down on the side of the UK government, but this idea, Tony, that had been put into the Crime and Courts Act, that media organisations would have to pay legal costs of libel cases, whether they won or lost, that was tantamount to a tyranny, in my opinion. So the second phase of an inquiry into phone hacking and the relationship between journalists and the police won't go ahead. How do you feel about that? Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, yeah, I'm happy to talk about Leveson. And, I mean, isn't it amazing how a whole bunch of criminality mainly at the News of the World and the Sun, you know, the Murdoch empire, can be turned into some way of gagging the press.
Yes.
I mean, this is what they do all the time, isn't it? You know, every time there's some kind of scandal, it's just a way of trying to get more power for themselves. I mean, I'm talking about the establishment, of course. You know, it's easy to, you know, people say to you, don't they? They say to me quite a lot, oh, who do you mean by them? You know, it's the establishment. The establishment, you know, effectively is the elite institutions like the media, the universities, the political parties, the major religions, also, you know, organized through gentlemen's clubs mostly in London. And, you know, this is them. This is the establishment, the Royal Society, you know, the Freemasons. They're all pretty much of one mind, which is that they should be immune from any kind of prosecution and run the whole show. And that's one of the reasons I just love Bilderberg, is because so many of these people pop up, people like Peter Thiel, who's the owner and founder of PayPal. He was one of the original funders of Facebook, along with Elon Musk. And he's an anarcho-capitalist. He believes in money, but he doesn't believe in people, and he doesn't believe in the law. So he's famous. There was a great little piece in The Guardian about him recently. His little motto is, democracy and freedom are incompatible. And this is one of the most powerful people in the world. He's creating all the kind of big new tech businesses, and you know, he has now bought land here in New Zealand because he thinks when the whole of the rest of it all goes down, New Zealand's going to be the place to be. He's now got himself an estate on the South Island. And, you know, that's the attitude, I think, of this super elite, is that, well, we're super rich. We're basically in charge. We're virtually gods. And in fact, through the transhumanist movement, they really, you know, many of them actually do believe they are gods. They're looking at high-tech genetic engineering to enable their children to live forever, but not everyone else's, this kind of thing. And it's well worth looking into the whole, I mean, I imagine you've had some stuff about transhumanism, but this is really the elite philosophy of, you know, we really are in charge of everything, and there is nothing else to kind of concern ourselves with. Technology, we can use it to rule the world, and we should use it to rule the world, and everyone else is stupid. So this is the attitude we're having to deal with, and none of this is being interrogated by any of our mainstream press at all.
No, absolutely not. And you have a situation today where Tom Watson, who's been, obviously, he's got a reason to be supportive of Max Mosley, and I have used, this, you know, odious to describe Mosley. I've used that term too many times, maybe, but he is odious. And you hit the nail on the head there, Tony, saying that the establishment tries to paint this situation. I mean, obviously, terrible things were done by journalists at the News of the World and the Sun, and Millie Dowler was a disgrace. We know that without rehashing that. And that's, there was always law to protect people against that. There was never any need to introduce any new law. But to hear Watson and the Labour Party today basically advocating things like, you know, Joe Bloggs can sue the Daily Mirror and the Mirror has to incur the costs. Jesus, Tony, it doesn't get any more tyrannical than that. It's ridiculous.
But it won't be Joe Bloggs. It will be the elite. Yeah, I mean, as a journalist, I think you have to just make this distinction between, yeah, you can have a go at anybody in journalism. I mean, that's your right. But, you know, I don't think we should be even thinking about having a go at anyone who's poor, homeless, the sort of thing the Daily Mail regularly does. The people to be interrogating are the rich and powerful, the rich and famous and powerful, the celebrities, you know, these kinds of people are the ones I think that need to be, interrogated. Let's just see if they are.
Let's just see
who they really say they are.
I'm going to argue with you there. The Mail is an enigma. It has done appalling stuff over the years, but increasingly in recent years, Tony, the Mail appears to be striving for balance to its credit. And if we put all of our disgust for the Mail historically to one side and look at it with a fresh pair of eyes, on many issues, it is providing both sides of the argument. I wrote an article about this actually a couple
brilliant.
Of weeks ago.
Look, it's been brilliant.
It's trying
actually,
anyway.
The Mail's been brilliant on a lot of things. On David Kelly, it was fantastic. On Stephen Lawrence, it was brilliant. But what they still do is they still have these kind of benefit scroungers. Look, the real benefit scroungers are the royal family. The real benefit scroungers are the super elite.
Absolutely.
These people are not, you know, the people that the Mail has a go at. I mean, the Daily Mail was originally created, the Northcliffe Empire, as a mass media kind of basically by the Tories for the Tories, so that millions of impoverished or natural Labour voters would have a Tory paper to read, and that the Conservatives would be able to get to all of the poorest people in the country and get them to think what they wanted to think. That was the Mail's original mission. But I take what you say. A lot of what the Mail's been doing recently has been actually exposing corruption in high places, and it's certainly got a place, just as all of the newspapers have. I mean, I think any professional journalist has this attitude. No one paper is any better than any other, really. But, you know, each of them will be publishing stuff independently. And that's another thing that's happened recently, is we've lost the independence of the Express. The Express wasn't independent under Richard Desmond, odious chap, but it was independent from the other empires. It's now been taken over by Trinity Mirror, which means that there's one less national newspaper of any kind of independent ownership. You know, these are things that are often missed in the press. I mean, we've had over here in New Zealand, just while I've been listening to the radio while I was over here and looking at the papers, something like 30 titles have gone because of the collapse of one of the branches of Fairfax Media, which is Australian-owned. 30 newspapers gone. In the blink of an eye.
That's dreadful, Tony. We talk about plurality issues and problems with plurality. You know, again, it's a great week to be talking about this. By the way, it's Tony Gosling, live on the line from New Zealand, thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show on BCFM, and bilderberg.org is a must-read website. We are going to talk, in 30 seconds, we're going to talk about the United States' involvement or looking to be involved in defence contracts to do with the European Union. We're going to talk about that in a second. We'll wrap up with that, because Tony's given us a lot of his time today, and I'm really happy with that. I've lost my train of thought there. What were you just saying, Tony?
Well, one of the things I'd love to mention the plurality, is because I stopped in Hong Kong on the way here, and it was I went into the what's called the Foreign Correspondents Club there.
All right,
which
right,
is an absolutely fascinating place to be. I mean, you can chit chat at the bar with the Washington Post Asia correspondent, some guy from the Asia Times I was chatting to. Really, really interesting to pick up on what's happening in Hong Kong, because the 100 years agreement ended in 1997. That wonderful director of the general of the BBC that tried to cover up Jimmy Savile as well, even Chris Patton, was over in Hong Kong with some ceremony to hand over to the Chinese, and they agreed in 97 that there was going to be a further 50 years in which the Chinese would not interfere in Hong Kong. That's up till 2047. And of course, what's happening is not happening. Is the Chinese are now really starting to interfere in internal politics within Hong Kong, even though people in Hong Kong don't have a proper democracy. They've got a kind of legislative assembly. They're even trying to interfere. They're stopping many of the best candidates actually being appointed to the legislative assembly. And they're also in mainland China arresting some of the journalists as they travel out of Hong Kong into mainland China for reporting on scandals to do with the senior members of the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing. So there's a real battle. And when I was chatting to some of the correspondents there, in fact, all of them, as soon as you bring up the issue of mainland China, there's a kind of shiver runs down the spine, even of these hardened correspondents wondering, good God, you know, we've got this massive thing to deal with here. And how long is Hong Kong going to have some form of press freedom? Because it certainly isn't the case in China. You know, there is no criticism allowed. We've now got President Xi saying he's going to stay in power forever. He's changing the constitution. Last year, he brought in all these laws to do with things like if you laugh at the national anthem, you go to jail for 3 years. I mean, there is no proper due process of law over there as well. They don't have habeas corpus, you know, for example. You can be arrested and just no one hears what's happened.
Just leave you there. That's right. You can be left there.
You know, so China, a lot of people paint China as a sort of fairly good, reasonable, and it is in a lot of ways. For example, you know, its policy in the Middle East to do with having a Palestinian embassy and a Palestinian government based in East Jerusalem is great, but it's an authoritarian country. And actually what's happening, I think, is the West is starting to take on some of these characteristics of authoritarian countries too.
Absolutely.
I mean, it seems pretty clear to me, Richie, where the war thing is coming from. Just take a look at Israel and Iran. They're basically shaping up to fight each other. And I think what will happen is you'll have some sort of spark between those two countries. And then that, of course, will bring the Russians in with the Americans. There will be some kind of fight between the Russians and the Americans. The Chinese will then come in on the Russian side. That's pretty obvious.
No doubt about it.
And there you've got a recipe for a world war. It could be triggered over in North Korea. And it seems as if that's another front that the Americans seem to, but it's quite clear the Americans want a war. They're losing control of their own country. It's basically run, Congress is run by the Israel lobby, it's bought most of the senators. And so I think we're in a pretty dangerous situation at the moment. The more I see Netanyahu clamping down, for example, on you know, on the Palestinians in all sorts of ways. I mean, we've just had the Church of the Holy Sepulchre had to close because of this new some sort of church tax over there. He is also under these corruption charges. So Netanyahu is fighting for his political survival, and it looks like he will be prepared to even start a war down there in order to be seen as a strong man to try and survive politically.
And deflect attention. Yeah, it's happened so many corrupt. Absolutely. It's happened so many times over the years. You're absolutely right. And we can finish on this, Tone. We can finish on this. Yeah, that was a great catch yesterday, that article on Reuters, about the comments of the mad dog. He called him Mad Dog Mattis, quite rightly. That's his nickname. Jim Mattis, the US Defense Secretary, was addressing a news conference, and he was in Brussels. This is a couple of weeks ago. But he was very, very clear on the need for the United States to allow the United States to play a part or a key role in any European defence pact. And this is something we've talked about in the past, you and I, and you've covered extensively on your own programme at BCFM, this European Union army. We've had political integration, fiscal integration. We're going to see military integration in the European Union, and the United States wants to be all over it, Tony.
Well, it's called the European Deterrence Initiative.
Yes.
And it's the first time I've heard of it. I mean, I find this term hilarious, really. I mean, you know, where is Spitting Image, please? You know, let's have some satire. That's all you need to burst the bubble of these idiots. Deterrence. What they're trying to imply here is that we've got to deter Putin from rolling his troops into mainland Europe and trying to take over America. Now, this is totally laughable. The EDI, they call it, you know. I just think that the policy in the West is controlled totally now, as we said earlier, with Mattis. And by the way, he was the butcher of Fallujah. Yeah, so
that's right.
He was the guy in charge of the Fallujah massacre.
Depleted uranium munitions raining down on children there.
He's been rewarded for that, you know, by giving him the top job. And that's where we are in the West now. You know, the more of a maniac you are, the more rewards you get. You get given more and more power. And, of course, the other major driver of all this is the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute for International Affairs. We were talking about journalistic bubbles and groupthink earlier. Well, they are really the people where a lot of this comes from. A lot of the journalists get their information from the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations in the US, and their journals, and they have bigger budgets than for communications than the Foreign Office or the State Department do. So we've got basically privatized policy through the CFR and Chatham House in London. But anyway, so what's happening is that because the Americans are so hell-bent on having a war in Europe, the Europeans are now saying, well, actually, we need some sort of independent military policy to the official NATO policy. Otherwise, we could be embroiled in an American war in Eastern Europe and have no independent policy from the Americans. Of course, the Pentagon's happy to have that because, of course, it's thousands and thousands of miles away from their mainland. But the Europeans are starting to wake up and saying, well, we're not going to have an American war, thank you very much, on our doorstep, because, you know, Germany would be flattened. Effectively, you know, the Baltic states would be flattened in such a war.
Scandinavia, of course, yeah.
Yeah, which is amazing to think that these sorts of things are, you know, it's only now dawning on these countries that maybe the American propaganda machine has been leading them up the garden path. But, I mean, you know, it has to be said, Putin, I think, a lot of what involved in his rise to power was pretty dastardly and underhand. For example, him tricking Boris Berezovsky into becoming president. I mean, that was, again, I suppose, masterful, really, in that Putin was involved in the cover-up of the bombings in 1999 in Moscow when he was, I think he was acting prime minister at the time. But he helped cover that up. And Berezovsky, the chief oligarch, thought, Putin is my man. You know, I can get him to do what I want. And he can be president. He can be my puppet president. And then literally within a couple of months of Putin becoming president, Berezovsky, who ran the major TV channels, I think he had the Mercedes franchise and various other big industries, privatized industries he picked up for pennies, suddenly found himself with a phone call from Putin saying, look, the police are coming for you, you're going to have to get out of the country within the next 24 hours, otherwise you may go to jail. And so Berezovsky was double-crossed by Putin, but as a result, he got the country back from the oligarchs, from the oligarchy. And the West, we need to have some courageous figures, I think, like Putin in the West, who are prepared to do that and, to take our countries back. We've made an attempt with Brexit, but quite how that will go is anyone's guess. It's going to be a roller coaster ride, Brexit, but a hell of an adventure. And I'm quite proud that Britain has been the first to stick two fingers up at Brussels and say, look, we're not going to be part of this United States of Europe.
We have to wait and see, of course, if we ever do exit properly or if we end up with a Brexit in name only, some sort of associate membership. But I absolutely agree with you. As an Irishman who remembers when the Irish rejected the Nice Treaty in 2000 and then the cabal insisted that Ireland vote again until it gave the right result and the Irish did, it's interesting. I just want to mention again, Tony can be found at thisweek.org.uk and also bilderberg.org. His programme, The Politics Show on BCFM, is a must listen to. It really is, folks. Check him out if you haven't heard him before. And you can follow him on Twitter. He's the only Tony Gosling on Twitter, is Tony. Thanks, mate, for giving us your time on your holiday.
No
I really
problem.
Appreciate it. I'm sure it's lovely there.
I'll be back in about. I'll be back on the radio show in about 2 or 3 weeks' time. I've got a couple of people covering for me for 6 weeks while I'm away. And you know, when I get back, what we'll do is we'll just try and pick up all the stories, which were, you know, 6 weeks worth of news on one program. So that should be quite a lot of fun. And we always have local politicians in as well, whether that's MPs or councillors, because you'll find that they don't get anywhere near enough exposure. You know, the people are actually grappling with these massive swinging central government cuts, local authorities. You know, with this cold, one thing I would say is just try and help out anyone that's homeless, because this is one of the things that's not being covered in the coverage here in New Zealand of the cold in Britain, is that this means people almost certainly die in the cold, because we've got, even just in Bristol, something like 400 people sleeping on the streets. They're the people that really need to have the attention in cold spells like this.
Well said, Tony. Absolutely right. If you're in the vicinity of anybody who's sleeping rough, a couple of quid for a blanket or a hot meal is not going to kill you. Well said, mate. Thanks for doing it. Enjoy the rest of your break. Sounds idyllic, and I look forward to hearing you when you're back live on your own programme real soon.
Cheers, Richie. God bless. All the best.
You too, mate. The great Tony Gosling, live on the line there from New Zealand. Great of him to do that. I didn't realise Tony was on holidays. I had this thing in my head that he was out there working, and I wouldn't have asked him to come on the programme otherwise, but he did, and he never mentioned the holiday, to his credit. Check out thisweek.org.uk. Check out bilderberg.org. Nobody is more qualified to talk about Bilderberg than him. He's done more research into it as an entity, its history, the careers of those who've attended it for all these decades now it's been going on. It's a great website, bilderberg.org. This is Thursday's Richie Allen Show. It's March 1st, 2018.